Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James. This week, I'm wearing a hat.
She is, guys. If you have our Patreon, you can see the hat.
I'm just going to talk about my hat a lot this episode, which plays great in an oral
medium. It does play in an audio world. But with us today, back writer, producer, director, Liz Hanna is here to talk with us about Sneakers.
I'm really just here to talk about Emily's hat. That's the gift that keeps on giving.
That's the gift that keeps
on
giving.
Do you think Robert Redford would like this hat?
I think he would.
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. Redford likes a hat. I mean,
loves
certainly
a hat.
Cowboy.
He loves a hat.
Yeah.
He loves
does.
A hat.
He does. So before we start, I just want to say, I know this episode drops in December and I know that this, you know, whatever, but like we got a WGA deal, guys, and it's worth us just patting ourselves on the back for hard work, and we got a great deal. So there you go.
I mean, we did hard work, the three of us in that room.
The three of
just,
us. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But I do think
this hat is a deal.
The hat did the work. The hat did all the work.
Yeah.
We got a deal. We're not on strike anymore.
Yes.
Who knows what the world will look like when this episode drops in
It'll
December.
Be in December. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. Hopefully SAG goes back in the room next week. To date ourselves when we're recording this.
Yeah, carbon
so
date this
happens.
Episode hard, but
I was gonna say, like, I think, like, all of us, just first off, a heartfelt thanks to everyone who supported us, and like, IATSE, SAG, all
Teamsters,
of the Teamsters, everyone who joined us and didn't cross lines and fought alongside of us, and and then to the negotiating committee and the board for getting, I think, what everybody agrees is a pretty exceptional deal for everybody. I mean, they got stuff for Comedy and Variety writers, which I think that never really happens. Usually Comedy and Variety and feature writers, frankly, get pretty forgotten about, and both were taken care of in this deal. So I don't know. Aside from being horrendously ill this week, which was a lovely way to come back from strike, I'm pretty blown away.
It needs to be said that Emily, who is a staff writer now, will get paid for her script. And that is
congratulations.
A big deal.
Huge deal. Huge deal.
This is a thing I've been thinking about. Obviously I've been writing freelance and stuff this whole time. Sure. But I worked one day in 11 months. And I got paid because of my severance and all that. I got paid for those full 11 months, and my severance is just running out. My last payment is on Monday, and I'm going to start up on the in the room again on Wednesday. And I'm just like, do I remember how to work? Like, is that a thing I still know how to do? I don't know. Actually,
well, I heard that's how we got a deal, is because they knew your severance was coming to an end, so they were like,
I think they heard that you bought the hat. I think
they heard you got a hat.
I think they heard.
They were like, Emily got a new picketing hat. And I mean, we don't, it's too powerful.
This is like not a joke. My one of my very good friends in LA has not met my son, who is almost 20 months old, and I've seen her multiple times, but like she just has never met him. And last week she was like, I'm coming over on Friday and I'm gonna meet your kid and we're gonna have lunch. And I was like, great. I'm not saying that this is why we got a deal. But we're not. She no longer can meet my son because she has to go back to her room. So I just want to say that she'll never meet him until
she's never gonna meet him.
Yeah. So there it is.
I mean, there it is.
Sacrifices have to be made. It's fine.
What if we got a deal because the sneakers broke into Netflix's servers and we're like, we have all the viewership data and we're gonna leak it.
Love it. It needs to be said that, Liz, I reached out to you many, many months ago when I was like, we're doing 1992, and right out of the gate, you're like, sneakers. Like, it wasn't even a question. This was the top of your list of 92 movies. What's your history with sneakers? Did you see it back in 92? Do you remember when you saw it for the first time?
I definitely saw it back. I don't know if I saw it in 92, but I remember seeing it when I was a kid. My parents loved this movie. My mom loved this movie. And so I remember seeing it a lot. We had the VHS. And then my husband, who has also been on this podcast, Brian, it's one of his top five favorite movies of all time, which was just like, when I met him, I thought was kind of weird. But then this was a little bit before the dawn of social media and writer Twitter. And then writer Twitter happened and it was not weird anymore, because this is, I think, like undeniably the movie that just every 4 to 6 weeks Sneakers comes up and is like, hey, if you haven't watched Sneakers, you should. And I would say, like, every time that happens, there's like three people who are like, oh my God, I've never seen it. It's a really good usage of writer Twitter, because you'll kind of get a new audience member every single time, which is nice. You don't often see that when people are like, hey, remember this movie? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I am part of the sneaker hive of Twitter. I'd like to say I'm like a founding member of it, but that might be too brazen.
Sure.
But yeah, it's just one of those movies that like you find another sneakerhead and you're like, let's go. Let's just fucking ball about Redford and Poitier and all the things we're going to talk about. Oh my God. I'm excited.
Emily, had you seen this movie?
No, this is my first time seeing it ever.
Okay.
It's you know, I you know what, I'll spoil it for you. I think it's pretty good. I think it's a pretty good movie. I liked it a lot, and I know that I'm gonna be like, yeah, B plus, and y'all are gonna be like, greatest movie, and I'm so we're gonna have a good time. It's gonna be,
great. Yes,
I think I think like B plus to A is like a fair place for it to live. Like I think it's definitely dated in some places. I have questions about some of the jokes in the movie. Like there's one joke in the movie that I feel like is probably dated and not a joke that should be in this movie, but I do not understand it. So I'm excited to get to that point.
Oh, I look forward to that. I also just feel like it's worth saying too, that this movie kind of, it exists in an interesting technological space as well, which I want to kind of unpack too.
Which I think is great. That's one of the best things about this movie for me. Yeah.
I will say, just sort of to follow up on my assessment of the film's quality, around the midpoint when they're having Robert Redford try to remember where he was by like thinking about, I was like, is this the best movie ever made? And then the second half kind of loses steam for me, but like not in a way that tanks the movie.
Is it Ben Kingsley's accent that makes you lose?
Hey, it's now. His little ponytail. I'm like, why do you have hair?
His little rat tail ponytail.
I also feel like, Emily, your husband's in this, David Strathairn, which we talked about.
I'm announcing to everyone that my wife and I are now in a polycule with the entire, like, not the cast of Sneakers, all the characters from Sneakers.
Yes, that is accurate. Yeah. Yes.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm with you. So I'm part of that as well. I just want you to know that this is, it might be like the hottest, oldest cast of all time.
I was just going to say, I think, I mean, outside of Aykroyd, sorry, Dan Aykroyd, but like I do, and even Aykroyd's probably in his best version of Dan Aykroyd, probably.
I mean, Winnebago, Aykroyd, okay. Like it's not the worst.
But like, it's amazing how hot this cast is.
I would like for us to visit a conversation that Phil and Brian and I were having while and I were in wine country and day drinking. Which is like hottest performances and like hottest eras.
We did talk
and about that. I think we need to have a conversation of Redford in this movie. And
absolutely.
Frankly, even Poitier, basically because Poitier like looks the same for 45 years. Yes. But like they may never have been hotter. It's really ridiculous.
It's really crazy how, and this is part of why like I think this movie has such love, is that first of all, like our parents grew up on these actors, right? So like to some degree, so like there is that. My mother loved this movie too, so like I was taken to see this movie in the theaters at 12 when probably like I don't know that a pseudo techno thriller with a bunch of quote-unquote old people was something that I really needed to see. So I think there was a generational thing.
It was the boppy jazz score that
it was the poppy jazz score. But I think that was part of why like we were all kind of exposed to it to some degree as kids. And then in hindsight, watching it the other day, I was just like, this cast really works well together. Like whether or not it was just sort of like we can get all these people. And it did seem as though from the research I did on the development of this movie, kind of no one really wanted to do this movie. And then Redford was like, I'm in. And then everyone just kind of jumped into the pool.
Yeah.
And I love that Redford saw this as a lane for him, which he kind of runs with for a few years after it as well, which is kind of great.
I mean, it's also, I don't know. We should get into it because there's a lot I want to talk about, but no, I just also want to say River Phoenix. I'm just going to put my River Phoenix.
River Phoenix.
Pin in the board.
River Phoenix. There is a moment at the end of this film when he takes his hat off and you're like, holy fuck. Like this guy
it's bizarre that like there's a weird and RIP because this is right around the time that he dies, not that long after this actually. And like Redford was for 25 years sort of like the hottest man alive and like very much that kind of Harrison Ford but like also very politically active, you know, like very much sort of this the movie star for a very long time. And in this movie playing like the dumbass is River Phoenix, who is that sort of next generation. Like he's about to be the next Redford, the next Harrison Ford, the next Brad Pitt, although I guess Brad Pitt and him are kind of the same age. And then he died. And like, it's just bizarre that this is sort of the movie that encapsulates that duo. And they have almost no scenes together except like when they're yelling at each other.
It's great. Or when they're both trying to look at people making out across the. So I'm going to give a little bit of context. Computer hacker Martin, played by Robert Redford, heads a group of specialists who test the security of various San Francisco companies. Martin is approached by two National Security Agency officers who ask him to steal a newly invented decoder. Martin and his team discover that the black box can crack any encrypted code, posing a huge threat. But if it lands in the wrong hands, when Martin realizes the NSA man who approached from rogue agents, they frame him for murder of the device's inventor. Sneakers opened on September 9th, 1992, against Honeymoon in Vegas, Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, Unforgiven, Single White Female, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $105 million worldwide on a $23 million budget. That's what I saw, Emily. I know that we had discussions.
I was just going to ask for covering Hellraiser 3, Hell on Earth, because that sounds great.
Whenever we decide to cover that, obviously. Sneakers has 80% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 80% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 stars, saying Sneakers tells the story of a legal break-in team. The computer stuff in Sneakers has been widely touted, but it is underwhelming in the movie. The big display of the secret program consists of a screen full of alphabet soup, which then unscrambles itself into a decoded message. There are good qualities to the movie. The break-ins are directed with skill and imagination by Phil Alden Robinson, who directed and wrote Field of Dreams. And his screenplay gives the character some interesting things to say. It is sometimes entertaining movie, but thin. I want to read just a small portion of an article that I sent to you guys. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, by past and future guest Kerry Corrigan. I know that, Liz, you were quite ill, so I didn't expect
I'm
you to read it.
I'm thrilled to read it.
I try not to read anything written by someone other than myself. So
that's fair.
Fair enough. So Kerry wrote this for Bright Wall Dark Room. She says, Sneakers is a film about a lot of things, ever-advancing modern technology, personal privacy in the early days of the digital age, still frosty international relations of the post-Cold War era, guys being dudes, the ways in which the American government, to put broadly, sucks, but it's also a movie about age. We can't just undo the things we did when we were young and stupid. We cannot expect that we can run away, change our names, change our lives, do one silly little good deed and be better. Erase the record of it ever happening. The past is always going to catch up with us. And the older we get, the harder it is to outrun. Our young, dumb selves are always waiting for us, lurking in the air vents, crouching under the stairwell, hanging just around the corner. I realize, of course, that saying all of this makes Sneaker sound terribly serious, which it is sometimes, but mostly it isn't. It's a Sunday afternoon kind of movie, the kind of lighthearted caper that walked so Soderbergh's Ocean's Trilogy could run, a film that is just as much about a good hang as it is a good heist. It's a great article that I highly recommend everybody read, because I do think that it gives a little bit of perspective on what I think is this movie really is about aging out a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's about sort of trying to catch up with technology and trying to catch up with your younger self. The movie opens in 69 with a young version, two actors who shockingly look very much like a young.
The Redford comp is wild.
It's like... wild. Yeah. And that whole idea of being sort of an anti-establishmentarian and then hitting a certain point in your life and having to sort of come to grips with the fact that you're no longer the rebel, I do think is also very much a part of this movie too. But...
I love the comp to Oceans. I think that also just in terms of like Oceans also exists in this weird point in technology where like you could still make a movie that takes place in current time. Mm-hmm. While not going overboard with the usage of it and not making it super informed by that. The age thing for me is something I've been thinking about a lot. I want to talk about the fact that Redford's playing younger here than he is in real life.
Yes.
Which is just like not like, like pretty dramatically younger than he is in real life.
Yes.
I think that is like something that did not occur to me until one of my quarantine walks this week of like, because I was like, well, how old could, I mean, truly, my first thought was like, how old could he have been in All the President's Men? As you know, is a movie that's very important to me. And then I found out he was almost 40 years old when he did All the President's
Men.
Really? Which then completely, that's crazy. Hang on, sorry. My iPad just started playing, which is Robert, great. So that's thrilling for me.
The Robert Redford arc is that like, he spends like 10 years trying to become a star. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood's like, this guy's a star, right? And it never works. And then Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, he blows up. But he's in his 30s when that happens. And it's
really
yeah.
I'm looking at his filmography. So I, full disclosure, did a Robert Redford double feature episode about 2 weeks ago on Indecent Proposal and Up Close and Personal, two movies that aren't great.
The
but
two
feature...
roles I most associate Robert Redford with. Yeah.
Interesting but decision.
It was an attempt to sort of harness in on the like hot older Redford, like a sort of horny older Redford thing.
Yeah.
But to your point, Emily, the early part of his career is kind of to your point, like 9 years of movies that don't really exist. And then it's barefoot
in
the park. In
there too. Yeah. Like he's obviously nothing wrong with doing bit parts in movies and doing guest roles on TV, but like, Hollywood was so sure this guy's a star, and ultimately they were right, but like it just, they could not figure out how to turn him around. I think because in that era, movie stars were increasingly like kind of character actor-y, you know, that Dustin Hoffman and De Niro and so on all broke through, and Robert Redford's classically handsome.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting then that he's paired with Paul Newman, who I think is similar to that, where he's like classically handsome. He kind of played character actor roles, but like was just always broke through because he was so magnetic. But I really like, if you had held a gun to my head, I would have been like, he was 25 when he shot Butch Cassidy in Sundance Kid. And I do think part of that is because of how much older Paul was in that. Like you just sort of feel like he's the old guy, you know? And like, by the way, not saying anybody in their mid-30s is old, bless. Please don't. But like, I genuinely thought this is when movie stars break. They break when they're in their mid-20s. So like, I assume that. I think it's so fascinating that he's not. And then like the run then that he goes on. The other thing that happens, and that I want to talk about with this movie, and I think this has to do with age and also with the difference of where we are now, where we make movies, is Redford got famous and I think became a movie star when he became political. Like he's the one who got All the President's Men. He's the one who produced All the President's Men. Mm-hmm. This movie is a political movie. It starts with them having the Republican National Convention make a donation to like Greenpeace or something.
Correct. It's Black Panthers, like, I think.
Oh, right. It's the Black Panthers. Amazing. And then they're talking about like they have Nixon's personal bank account. Like, woo, where are we going to get that money? Like, yeah. They talk about Reagan and how bad he is in this. Like, it is a constant film about how bad Republicans are and how great liberal Democrats are. I just think it's fascinating to, like, first of all, we could not make that movie today and have it be a blockbuster. And we couldn't make that movie today and have anyone greenlight it for this type of budget.
Sure.
And then, but you kind of look at his career and you look at, I'm also rewatching Watchmen. So, like, Redford is, political Redford is top of mind. But, like, I think it's really fascinating to see those two things kind of become parallel with each other and how he really wasn't shy about it, you know, that he was always pretty outspoken.
He's not shy about any of his political beliefs, really. At the same time, he's not, like, I mean, I do think it's interesting that this movie is also about a fear of technology, a fear of information, a fear of, like, the government, you know, manipulating all of these various things. He doesn't, I mean, I don't know. As political as he is, he's also kind of a little bit apolitical. Like, I don't feel as though he's a guy who's really sort of.
Well, I don't think he's radical, forceful. But I wouldn't. But,
yes.
Yeah. I don't think he's a radical political operative, but I do think like he's not Republican. Like, that's, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You can establish that he's like not a conservative Republican, which I think and he isn't shy about coming out and saying that, which that at a minimum, I think is impressive of just sort of where we've come to and where we're at.
Yeah. I want to say that growing up very conservative, Robert Redford was on like a list. He wasn't Jane Fonda. Jane Fonda was like the top of list of like, we don't like her. But like it was her and Beatty and Redford as just like, these are crazy wacko lefties. Yeah. And like Redford's like not that far left. He's like 7 out of 10. But like, yeah, that was, and I do wonder, this movie by no means was a flop, but it made less money than you'd expect it to, and then anyone expected it to when it was greenlit. It made $51 million in the US. Mm-hmm. And I do think some of it is that this movie is sort of forthrightly has characters who are forthrightly anti-Republican. And it plays it jokey, but yeah.
I mean, no, when it's like this, it's like the third or fourth scene when he gives money to the homeless man and he's like, the government is taking my apartment. He's like, talk to that guy, and it's a picture of Ronald Reagan. Is it right? It's Reagan.
I think it's Bush. It's Bush.
Oh, yes. I need to. It would be Bush. Yeah. Kind of. but I think it's interesting how much they, although it is funny that they don't make a bigger joke about Bush being the former head of the CIA, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So, literally blame him. But I think it's, I don't know. I think just in talking Redford, like it's hard to not parallel his career with sort of with politics. I mean, he established himself so quickly as a political figure, you know, in Hollywood. I also just read the George Clooney quote about what he said to Trump, and it's iconic. If we're going to have new Redfords, I think Clooney's up there.
I think that the thing too about Redford is how the aesthetics fold into the perception of him, right? Like he is such an all-American, blonde hair, blue-eyed. Like the reason he doesn't get The Graduate is literally because of the way that he looks. Mm-hmm. And Mike Nichols being like, this is not what we're going for. And I think that kind of also makes people assume a certain thing about him, right? That he kind of looks like a Republican. Like, I mean, not to, you know.
You're talking to somebody whose son literally looks like he's the chair of the Young Republicans League. He has the Redford look. He has like the long blonde hair.
It's amazing.
And the rosy cheeks. He just looks like it. I get it. I think I think it's really interesting that he then combats it by being like, but I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm talking about my son, not Redford, obviously.
Yes,
Your son is very active. Like I have frequently been harangued by him about like,
I know, how he's always asking questions. Like
we should be saying yes in my backyard, not no in my backyard.
I know.
Yeah. Like he corners me at every party.
I'm so sorry.
It is interesting.
For those
too,
that don't know, my son is 19 months old. So at this point, this is funny.
I do think, though, that, you know, and then on top of everything, you have obviously the Sundance Film Festival. You have sort of Redford being sort of this very pro art form guy who believes in sort of, you know, people having the freedom to be able to express themselves however they see fit, which I do think falls into this film. I mean, I do think that this movie is about sort of, you know, freedom of identity, freedom of information, you know, the fear of people manipulating it, and just government organizations in general. I mean, this movie is pretty...
I think this movie is about how hot he is. Like, look, I would love to have a conversation about the politics, but like, he wears those jeans well. Let me just say, he wears some tight-ass jeans in this movie, and I was like, whoa, hello, sir.
Yeah, this movie's mostly about hotness.
It really is. Like, you look at the first of all, I love that the VHS box is just like a list of there's very few movies. I mean, it's really like Oceans, like these ensemble movies. You could do it with The Big Chill now, but not then. Like, they weren't movie stars now then. It's Redford, Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, David Strathairn.
Mary McDonald,
Ben Kingsley, like it, bangers all across the board. I think every single one of them have been nominated or won an Academy Award, which is fucking wild. Like, it's wild. Just they're all hot. Like, I don't know if they're all peacocks, but they're all hot.
Yeah, there's a thing, like, we're talking about this movie in terms of like sort of lofty themes and political ideals and stuff. And that's in there, but this movie's just The Big Chill with Goonies. Like, that's all it is.
I 100%.
It's like, what if we were disillusioned middle-aged hippies, but also we had like a treasure map? And it's like, okay, like that's great. That's great fun. And like, I know this was born out of research for War Games. But yeah, like, I think, you know, I certainly don't think that it's not worth discussing the politics of this movie, because they're interesting. And I think in many ways, it's a movie that was released at exactly the wrong time. And that's part of why it wasn't a hit. I mean, it was a double. Like, I'm not going to say it didn't make money, but
it's, I mean, you texted me and you were like, what if it came out in like 97 or something along those lines? I honestly think 94, like even just deeper into the Clinton
years.
Here's
the big problem. It comes out at a time, 1992, when we haven't figured out the new geopolitical state. So this movie's kind of like, is Russia the enemy?
Have we figured that out yet?
Are we mad at Russia?
When are we going to figure that out?
I mean, no, like now, like if you made it in 97, it would be stateless terrorists. You know, by then we'd sort of figured out terrorists are, we don't like them. And like, if you made it in 94, I think you'd still kind of be in that Cold War after haze. Also, it's made too early for people to really be into computers, but it's like a very, like, it's very attached to a brand of democratic politics superficially, not very deeply, but that was sort of going out of favor. Like, Bill Clinton is the Democrat who's not any of those things.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's out of time in a weird way, where I think 97 people were getting tired of Clinton. It would have been terrorists. You know, people were very into computers at that point. I think that, you know, my wife was like, I always get that movie confused with Hackers. And I was like, Hackers came out several years later. And she was like, well, there you go. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
They're also several years younger than the entire cast of this movie.
And that movie's also, that movie's very like, fuck the man, anti-establishment. How do we, you know what I mean? Like, hack the planet. Like, it was
that
just this whole
bad,
like,
right? I haven't seen that since I was like 14.
There are people that
bad.
Love it though.
Okay. All right.
But I think it's more nostalgia, but you know.
I think there's something like, just in, now that Angelina Jolie is Angelina Jolie, like there's something very fascinating to watch, and basically, and you know, like one of her first role, and then the two of them get married, but like one of her first roles, I always say, like, you can still see that she's going to be Angelina Jolie through the cracks of the movie. But I think, going to what you're saying though, there is one problem that I think wouldn't have worked in 97, and I think works against this movie in 1992. They're hot, but they're old. Yeah. Like, who's going to see this movie? I think that for me is like, the fact that this, also the name of the movie, bless its heart, is Sneakers, which like doesn't tell anybody. I read in something that like Phil Alden Robinson had to add profanity to the script so that it wouldn't get a G rating, so that like people would know it was not a kids movie. Yeah. Which I love that they were like, we're not changing the title, we're gonna add fucks. Like, it's just like, okay, I like the where everybody's at, but it's interesting to me.
Did you ever play that game where, like, as a kid, that they had in every school, I think, where there's like a guy with a big hat, he pulls down like big shoes and big, and he walks around solving math problems?
Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar.
No. That if you had named this sneakers and it was rated G, I would have been like, is this just an adaptation? Is it just like Robert Redford walking around solving math problems? Would watch, but.
But I think that, like, yeah, the title, title and then the age of the cast, again, bangers, all hot. But, like, I don't know who this movie is directed to, directed at, other than boomers of that era, our parents, who were Democrats. Like, I think that's, like, it's a very specific group of people. And then it's also people who, like, watch the trailer and understand kind of what the movie is versus the title. So it's an, the fact that all of these things happen, that it still made $100 million worldwide, and that it is, like, the biggest writer Twitter movie of all time, is fascinating to me.
I bringing up the writer thing, I think, is worth noting just for a second, too, because I do think that this movie, as I was watching it this time, I was painfully aware of what you were talking about, Emily, of that this movie really, the mission of this movie doesn't kick in until, like, an hour 10 in terms of, like, what they're really going to do. And I think that's also a vestige of, like, 80s, right? So, like, it feels structurally like it's kind of still existing in a time that, if you release this in 97, you'd need way more shit happening in that first, you know, hour, 10 minutes.
But guys, he has to walk super slow.
He has to walk super slow.
It feels, it's not produced by Spielberg, but it has that late 80s yes. produced by Spielberg yes. feel. The music yes. is very soaring yep. at times. Yeah. That James scene Warner. Where yeah. David Strathairn oh, is driving the van, yeah. even though he's blind. Yeah. It's like, I'm like, this is such a, like, it yeah. just, a lot of this movie, I think part of the disconnect we feel on how old they are is they kind of behave like they are in E.T. Just a little yes, bit.
Totally. Yes, totally.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, can, it is a Parks McDonald movie. They do yeah. produce things with, they have produced things with Spielberg. Like, it has that vibe.
You can, I mean, like, and I feel like it's there. There are some actors you can get away with that with, but I'm sure. not sure, like, Redford. I'm not sure Redford tracks for the audience in that way. Like, I think he's great in this movie. And I think he sure. sells it. But I think if you are just, like, a casual moviegoer who's like, what the fuck is this? Like, that just, like, it doesn't quite add up.
He falls over the counter like 3 minutes into the movie, and it's kind of genius in the Redford and Field and Robinson statement of, like, this will not be a cool Redford movie. Like, there's something really interesting about, he's going to trip, he's going to fall, he's going to make an ass of himself. Like, but people who are going to see this movie are not, like, they don't know, you know, that's, they're expecting Redford the hero. Like, this is not that. The David Strathairn driving the van, which is, David Strathairn in this movie is iconic. He's so great.
So good.
He's so funny. Whistler. So funny. Does it sound like a cocktail party? So funny. That is the biggest set piece in the movie. Him driving the van blind while they are coaching him is literally the biggest set piece in the movie, which
or
is.
Or Redford moving slowly.
Which I think is, going to what you're talking about of sort of like the Amblin world, is like, it wasn't really meant in the 80s. It wasn't about the set pieces. It was about the family and the community. And then, like, we have a, and then E.T. flies. It's like, you know, it's not about that, which I think is really interesting. There's a scene in this movie. So I was rewatching the first like half hour this morning with Brian. There's a scene in this movie that is so Spielberg and it's so wild. It's the scene where Redford goes to meet with, my guy,
your guy,
West Wing,
Busfield.
Yes. Goes to meet yes. with Busfield and yes. Papa Kent at the NSA office. It is a oneer. That scene is a oneer. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Brian was like,
when they're in that glass room or whatever,
when they're in the yeah, room, it's yeah, a oneer yeah. and it's super Spielberg staged where it's like everybody's just making slight movements to kind of get out of the way, but it all feels really natural. It was so, I mean, I've watched this movie 30 times. I didn't notice it until I was like,
that's interesting.
Until frankly, Brian was like, was that a oneer? And I was like, no. And then I went back and he was correct.
Sure.
But it's really, I there feels a lot taken from the Spielberg Amblin era of things. Sure. It's just that everyone is about 40 years older than the normal cast of characters.
Field of Dreams is that too. Phil Alden Robinson as like new Spielberg, because everyone was trying to find the new Spielberg at this point in time, is like an interesting, weird evolutionary path. And instead, he just like after this is just not a big hit. Yeah. He stops making movies for a long time.
He writes some stuff as a different. He writes under a different name.
Does he write under Emily St. James? Alden Robinson?
He doesn't.
That'd be weird.
But he writes Ghost Dad, or a version of Ghost Dad.
Unproblematic film.
Nothing problematic about that movie. And he also does a version of The Chamber, the John Grisham movie.
Did he direct that movie too?
He didn't. I believe it. I'm not sure who directed it. But then I guess he wrote Juliet Naked, or a version of that script, did a rewrite on that. So like, I guess he's just kind of, long story short, he kind of goes away. Field of Dreams is a great movie, a huge hit, an iconic movie. He does Sneakers in 92. He does a film called Freedom Song in 2000, which I've never heard of.
It's a TV movie, I believe.
Okay. And then he does Some of All Fears, which was like a big attempt to sort of reboot the Jack Ryan thing with Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman. Never seen it, but
they
look on it.
Baltimore in that.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Okay. The Baltimore, like, Oriole Stadium gets
nuked.
Literally a nuclear bomb goes up. The Son of All Fears is like a fascinating movie to me. Whenever I try to like reboot sort of iconic characters, it's so fascinating. Like, they kind of did it. No shade on The Hunt for Red October, but I think we can all agree that Harrison is a much better Jack Ryan. And like trying to put, I think ever for anyone ever trying to replace Harrison Ford is like a fascinating problem. Yep. There is something about the movie where Ben Affleck really works in it, because he's not like Batman Ben Affleck. He's like, I buy you sitting behind a desk and being an analyst Ben Affleck. Also, Liev Schreiber plays like the badass in the movie, which is really just amazing.
Great.
It was supposed to be released like on 9/11. Like it was like supposed to be released September 2001.
Yeah.
It was a movie that I think like wouldn't have been such a failure had it not
come out right after
worldwide, tragedy happened. But I don't know, it's not bad. Like director wise, it's not bad.
I think Phil Alden Robinson's a good director. And I'm a little surprised that, I mean, as we've said, this movie wasn't a huge hit, but this movie wasn't a failure. Like the fact that this would put somebody in quote unquote movie jail. And I don't mean to suggest that that's what happened. Maybe he was just like, I don't know.
The September 9th date is interesting. That suggests that this movie, which had a lot of hype as a script, the studio looked at it and was like, we don't know how to sell this. We're just going to dump it.
Yeah.
And we're going to help the stars carry it, to which to some degree they did, because it did do well. But I think there was a lot of hype around this. Somebody who like read it was like, that's what $100 million script looks like. And, obviously, if we believe the worldwide numbers, which I was never able to source, so I'm not sure I do, but I'm going to just say I believe it did make $100 million worldwide, but it made $50 million domestic. And at that time, that was a lot more. So like, I do think the studio didn't have faith in this for whatever reason. So, and I will say this.
Yes.
This is a cable movie. Like, this is kind of a better cable movie than a theatrical. And like, that's obviously going to be its long tail. You know, this movie has commercial breaks built into it in a real way.
This is a movie that, I mean, I watched it a lot as a kid on VHS. This was just one of those movies that, and again, I think it's just to highlight what both of you are saying, which is, I think it is the Spielbergian kind of Amblin-y vibe that just worked for me as a kid. And you've got these, you know, classic great actors that are just killing it, that as a kid I didn't necessarily translate that, but now I'm like, I probably just recognize that these people are fucking good at their jobs, and like, they're just good actors. It is kind of weird that they didn't know what to do with it, because it does feel pretty promotable to me. Like, even the poster, which is them like peering underneath a peeled up portion of the poster, I'm just like, you didn't put their faces on the poster.
I mean, I have to say, like, I don't think they thought that hard about this because they left the name Sneakers in as the title of the movie, which, like, is never mentioned once. It's not like that was their nickname. It's not like that's their company name. Like, it's not, it doesn't make sense at all that that is, like, that's not like lingo that we use for hackers. It's so it's just like a weird misrepresentation of the story. I think the thing like that maybe fights against it, or why it fought against it when it was released, has the longevity is the tone is so good in this movie. And this goes to the Amblin conversation and I think the Steven conversation, because I feel like Spielberg is obviously known for almost everything, but I think the thing that is the most underrated about him is tone. Like, he just gets it, and he knows how to make adults love a movie, and he knows how to make kids love a movie, and he like has it. And so does Phil Alden Robinson. Like, Field of Dreams shouldn't be that funny, and like James Earl Jones is just a comedian in the movie. Like, he's just flat out hilarious. Amy Madigan is fantastic. Like, there's so much comedy in that. Like, Kevin Costner is just sort of like the dolt in it. Like, he's just kind of like bumbling. And then in this, just like everyone is, he's like, Redford's a little bit the straight man, but like Sidney Poitier is hilarious in it. And the comedy of the tone, and then sort of Redford bringing us back down to reality of like, we're all going to get killed, works for this movie when you rewatch it and when you become sort of like ingratiated with how I think as an adult of where you're like, is this a Sidney Poitier comedy? Are those words that go together? Like, it's amazing.
Absolutely. I also think
James Earl Jones cameo in this is also like, James Earl Jones is like, he's been funny in many things, but he's very, and he's like, he is playing a straight man, but his increasing exasperation with, again, the characters in this movie behave like kids, and it's just, it's interesting, but there's also like, you know, that last scene where they're all asking for like their big things, you're like, that could be done with the Stranger Things kids.
Absolutely.
Well, it's done with the Armageddon cast 20 years later, so
absolutely. I also think, just to underline the tone of it all, like, this movie is very playful, but it also has kind of a menacing spookiness to it in a totally like approachable way. I also think so much of that goes,
I'm just gonna say, no, it doesn't. I don't think it has that at all.
I actually think when I say that, I mean in the Spielbergian sense of the term, not in the, like, that's what I mean, that like, it has some stakes to it, and I think that the score leans into some of the, there's a little bit of menace to Ben Kingsley in this movie. He's not Sexy Beast or anything like that, but like, there is something.
Or is he?
What if he came in as his Sexy Beast character?
That would be
just
something.
Entered the middle of this movie and was like, yes, 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 yes.
This feels a little closer to like Iron Man 3 in his performance world.
Sure, sure. But I also think, you know, we talked about this, Kenny and I talked about this early in our 99 thing, but there is something about being in steady hands and knowing intent, and it that's everything. Field of Dreams is a perfect example of a movie that, if you think about, makes no fucking sense. I don't know what the rules are necessarily of what's going on in that movie, but it totally works because you're just like on a ride and you know that this person.
I still don't know if people can see the baseball players.
This is
like,
my point.
I don't have a problem with it, but I am 37 years old and I don't understand if people are coming to look at an empty fucking field, or if, like, in the Field of Dreams universe 30 years later we are all going there because holy shit, it's aliens didn't show up. There's, you know, like, time. it wasn't the Leftovers. It is just, we got the 1927 White Sox to come and play baseball on a field in Iowa.
Yeah, it's time to reboot Field of Dreams. It's a limited series, but it's a legacy.
They tried.
Listen, here's the thing though. Like, y'all, this is, you know, sometimes I bring my knowledge of having grown up in the country, and sometimes.
Are you wearing your knowledge hat?
Yeah, I'm wearing my knowledge hat. Yeah. Sometimes baseball ghosts come out of a cornfield. Sometimes that's just a thing that happens where I grew up.
I get it.
You're like, okay, sure.
I get it. But does everybody see them?
This is the thing. This is, we're in our blue America bubble. We don't understand that, yes, everyone sees the baseball ghosts back where I come from. You have to believe. You have to believe.
Right. You have to believe.
And we're so cynical.
That's the rule, or that's the like thing of that movie that really gets me is like, so I can't see them if I don't believe in them. Like, but why couldn't just everybody see them? Also, they can't leave the baseball daemon. They'll die, but because of the rocks, but he doesn't die. He just turns into a man that was already dead. So then he dies again. There's a lot. I got some questions. I got some notes.
But this comes back to sort of my point about this movie, which is that if you put this movie under a microscope, I also think you'd have questions, right? But like
a lot of notes on this one. I'm not going to lie. Don't have a lot of
questions.
You
do or don't.
I do not. You know why? Well, pretty thin.
Okay.
So, because like, there's actually not that much to poke holes in. The one thing I have a note on, Brian and I were talking about this, is so the amazing James Earl Jones scene, which Brian might have to come in to do an impression.
Oh, God.
Or maybe not. But the "this is not a car dealership, pal" is like maybe the greatest line of all time. Yeah. It's incredible. The scene, so they get all of these things, right? They get like, he's going to Tahiti with his wife. He's getting all these things. They
he's getting
get
a Winnebago.
He gets a Winnebago. Yeah. Then the next thing we hear is that the Republican National, or like the Democratic Convention or whatever, is that they've got
the RNC
ton
is
of
out
money.
Of money.
The RNC is out of money, and then there's like been donations made elsewhere. And da da da. Wouldn't James Earl Jones just immediately be like, "Yo, Redford, you fucked me, bro. Like, give me the Winnebago back." Like, that's my first.
They'd all,
like,
first of all,
real,
they'd
no.
all be. Absolutely killed. They'd all be buried. Like they're all dead. Like, there's no way that the government allows them to walk away with the chip. I don't know. I feel as though this movie. I know you don't have any questions, Liz, and that's great.
I have none. Zero. None. But my only question is why didn't we get a sequel? But I understand it. It's fine.
I don't have any questions either. I think this movie explains itself pretty well.
Okay,
like, but
I
here's
mean, they
the
did
thing.
Have
like,
help from the Office of Naval Intelligence.
I used to like be very into like hacking stuff. Like, I didn't like hack anything. I've never hacked, but like, I would read about it, and like, all the stuff in this movie is drawn from that in like a way that was instantly sort of readable to me. I would have called this movie "Freaks with a PH" because that's what they do. They phone freak. A lot of what they do is phone freaking, and you use the PH, and that immediately gives you like, what the fuck is that? And then Robert Redford can go on. Is Johnny Carson still alive? Yeah, probably. Robert Redford can go on the Tonight Show and be like, well, you see, a freak is when you're hacking with a phone. That's why it says PH, PHREAKS. And Johnny Carson's like, oh, that's interesting. That's so
I'm not
this.
Against it.
Yeah. I think I think this is a movie where you got to have a weird ass title. So
I just think I'd be uncomfortable with that title and like Redford's chase on it. It just feels like his, it feels like I just would be like, you're not cool. Like, you like, it'd be like a thing where you're like, Redford, stop trying to be cool. You're not cool. Like, this, what makes you cool is wearing the baseball jacket that you're wearing out of your like beat up Carmangia.
By the way, same jacket from The Natural.
I read that. That's wild.
Which I think is amazing.
Thinking about like the tech angle of this movie, like it was written, it came out of research they did for War Games, and like the stuff they couldn't fit into War Games because War Games was like very much, and you can see the lineage there. But if they had just made this in 1985, like then I think like it, like a lot of the like stuff that feels weird that middle-aged people are doing it, they would have been like, not 10 years. You could have credibly gotten away with having a 10 actors who were 10 years younger playing everything in 85.
Sure.
And I think that some of it would have scanned a little bit more, but I don't know.
I want to see where Redford was at in his career.
I just like wanted,
he was in an interesting place.
I think
it was literally right after Indecent Proposal.
The poster should have been Redford pulling open like a jacket, and his t-shirt says, "Hell yeah, I'm a freak," and it's called PH.
I want to just talk, before we talk where Redford was, you brought up the technology thing, and I think it's worth I just want to read a very small quote from Carrie's article about this, because I think it taps into something that I think is very interesting. To genuinely believe that a whole new rotten system won't spring up in the aftermath, that people won't find a way to establish social hierarchies, that it could be possible in the state of capitalist reign to fully bleed the ideology from our DNA is to be either very young or willfully ignorant. Martin knows this. Cosmo isn't, unlike many techno-fascists today, or disruptors who break the systems under the guise of democracy, but really it's assertions of power. They're agents of chaos, not change, out to remake the world in their own image. And I have to say, watching it this time, Cosmo did feel very Elon, very Zuckerberg to me, of like a guy who just kind of really just wants to break everything and isn't really all that interested in putting it back together again.
I don't think Cosmo would travel down to the border and wear a cowboy hat backwards. I feel like he'd be smarter than that.
That happened today, Liz. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yes.
Elon went down to the border with a cowboy hat.
Elon went to the border, took
How
a congressman.
Cowboy hat backwards? There's a right way.
It doesn't look great. It doesn't look great. Emily's going to do it right now. Just
It just looks weird. Like you could, it's not.
It's off.
It's not.
That's
wrong.
Okay. I'm just going to say it's not terrible. I'm going to say it's not. By the way, this
looks worse on
Elon. Comment. I'm just saying, he can wear anything the right way. He still looks like a fucking prick. But I'm just curious of how.
You can tell he's never worn a cowboy hat.
That's the point.
It sits kind of high on his head. He's got it backwards. He's wearing sunglasses. He's wearing a weird t-shirt. My favorite tweet described him as, it looks like when you go to the customization shop in Grand Theft Auto, but you don't have enough money, so you just buy random stuff.
Well, he does have enough money.
I hate
billionaires
it so much,
it's just like, ugh.
How does he not have a stylist?
That's what I'm about to say. Like, people who dress poorly and have millions and millions of dollars, I truly do not understand. It does not make sense to me. It's also, you're wearing jeans and a t-shirt. It shouldn't be that hard.
I don't disagree.
I'm a low-level staff writer, and I always look great. So
you do. It's true, Emily.
Elon.
Have we talked about the hat yet today? I don't know that we have.
I'm excited for
people on the Patreon to see the hat.
They're going to see the hat, and it's going to be great. I do think, though, that there is this, especially with Cosmo, the Cosmo Martin relationship, which starts from a place of being sort of immature and looking to sort of break the system. Cosmo never grows up, right? Cosmo goes to jail, is thought to be dead. And then spoiler, he's not dead.
He has a ponytail, though.
He has a ponytail. And an accent? I don't know what the accent is.
Guys, we got to talk about the accent.
Is it Brooklyn? Is it? Because Mahdi is basically the only time we hear it.
It's really bad. It's really bad. It's
it's weird.
I don't know where he's... I have a question. Why did he have to have an accent at all?
Is this leftovers from Bugsy? Because he does Bugsy in 91. And I'm wondering if this is just
why Leo has had the same accent from since
just couldn't shake it.
New York. Yeah.
I don't know. Because it's very odd. I don't know what he's doing. But I do like the fact that, in terms of what happens ultimately, Martin gets away with it, goes to Canada. I don't know, on his jaunt to Canada, then goes to San Francisco, changes his name, lives under an alias, and is sort of running this kind of, ragtag group of people that do this job. And in the sort of years that have gone by, I think Martin has kind of become a little bit more grounded and is a little bit more self-aware. Cosmo hasn't, and he wants to kind of wield this power with this technology. To what end, I don't really know, though. Cosmo's in with mobsters and I just don't totally know what he wants to do with
this. This is not a problem with the movie, but I think it is interesting that it does not posit Martin as being a fulcrum point between someone who's more establishment and then the total anti-establishment behavior of Cosmo.
Yes.
If the guys from the government were actually from the government and not just working with Cosmo, you'd then you'd feel maybe there's a push and pull, but it's just kind of Martin doesn't really have to grapple with the way that he's sold out, I guess.
Correct.
Which is a conflict you expect to be set up from the first scene that kind of is there, but also they don't seem that interested in it.
I mean, when we meet Martin, as you mentioned, Liz, he's falling over counters. He doesn't really have his shit together. You've got that great moment with the clerk that's doesn't sound like much of a living or something to that effect.
She hands him a check and is like, "Ooh, it's so brutal."
It's really brutal. Yeah. So he kind of is existing, but even he knows he hasn't fulfilled his potential. Yeah. You know, which I do think is an interesting way to come into this character. And I would argue, Emily, to your point, by the end of this movie, has he fulfilled his potential? I mean,
he got Liz back, even though she said that she wasn't going to start dating him again. So there's that.
True. He did win the girl.
Here's where I do have notes. I don't have notes on the logic, but I have notes on her character. Sure. Who the fuck is she? She's
teaching a kid piano.
She's a piano teacher, but she's also like a genius chemist and mathematician and like knows all these people.
That's right. He tells her to come with him because he just.
Yeah. My theory actually is that she like was somehow involved in the government or in like rebellious not because she knows who he is.
She does.
Basically, I'm pitching the prequel. Like, let's do the prequel. How Liz and Martin met story.
But I also feel like, I'm wrong, but did you guys get the sense that she worked with them in the past with this team? Okay.
And
Because they all stop. They all stop walking.
Right.
And then they turn around. I definitely got that. Yeah. I'm sorry, just to go real quick back to his career, which I think is really fascinating.
Yes, yeah, please.
Okay. So he has his 70s run.
Yes.
Where he's the biggest movie star on the planet.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Men. So all the president's men, 1976. Yes. Then we do A Bridge Too Far, mm-hmm. The Electric Horseman,
mm-hmm.
Brubaker,
mm-hmm.
which made no money. And then he directs Ordinary People, iconic, back on top, like incredible, incredible movie. If nobody's
seen it. Is he the first, forgive me, I could be wrong. Is he the first actor director to win Best Director? It feels like he was the beginning of something. Am I totally wrong?
Orson Welles didn't win, but he was nominated, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't?
I'm looking this up. I feel like I think he is the first, but I'm going to make sure.
That movie, by the way, fucking bangs.
Laurence Olivier.
Oh, okay.
For a Shakespeare?
For
Henry V?
Hamlet.
Hamlet.
Or did he? No, he lost. He lost to John Huston. Well, fuck him.
Okay.
John Huston's an actor. There you go.
Yes. But he was known as a director first.
It just feels like Redford to me is the beginning of actor, certainly male white actors, thinking that they can direct. Anyway, moving on.
It's definitely like the beginning of a wave of them happening. You know, whether want to say like Mike Nichols was an actor, which he kind of was, you know, but like it's this wave.
But then you get Costner a few years later, and I mean, like it happened. Anyway,
I mean, it's literally Redford
doing it.
Yes.
Okay, so
Woody Allen. I think Woody Allen's the starting point.
Let's just we don't need to talk about Woody Allen. We're going to move past that. We will talk about him at some point. We have two movies from 92 that talk about him.
Oh, no.
We got Husbands and Wives and Shadows and Fog to talk about at some point, Emily.
We could just skip those.
Yeah, we could skip those. Emily, sorry, Liz.
I feel like he's... You don't talk about him.
Then it's out of Africa.
19, Ordinary People.
Yeah.
The Natural, 1984. Out of Africa, 1985. So he's back on top. And then, once again, we go Legal Eagles, Waiting for the Moon. No, sorry, that was a thank you. Legal Eagles, The Milagro Beanfield War, which he was the director and producer of, which made no money.
That doesn't exist.
Won an Oscar for score.
Oh, okay.
Pretty good score.
But so there's not a lot of acting. So he goes from Legal Eagles to, which is 1986, to Havana in 1990.
for Paula.
No Money.
A movie that also doesn't exist.
And then he does Sneakers in 92. So yeah. It totally, I want to talk about it because it totally makes sense to him, to me, that he does Sneakers actually now. Because he is searching for his acting career. Like, who am I now in my mid-50s, late-50s, like, as an actor?
And I'll say, too, I thought that Indecent Proposal came before it, but it comes after it. You've got Indecent Proposal going into Up Close and Personal, The Horse Whisperer. It feels like there's a kind of run here where he's like, can I be old sexy guy? Can I be like, can I, you know, be that for moms type thing? And then it's the last act of his career, not last, I mean, he's not dead. Who knows what he's going to do? But I do think that, like, you know, Last Castle, Spy Game, you know, Lions for Lambs, All is Lost. All
don't shit on Spy Game. Spy Game's a banger.
Spy Game's good, but like, I think it's kind of fascinating.
If we're talking hotness, we got to talk Brad Pitt hotness in that movie. He is real peak hotness in that movie. And
this also,
like,
came up on our text thread.
It did. And also putting Brad Pitt and Redford together, like, in those eras of their careers is sort of ingenious because it feels like, now is the movie fantastic? No, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good, and they're great together.
Emily, are you a Spy Game head?
I don't think I've ever seen it.
I think you'd like it.
I'm looking at looking at Robert Redford's career because he famously like retires with The Old Man and the Gun in 2018,
quote unquote retires.
Well, he's hasn't really like he did a cameo in Avengers Endgame, which was almost certainly to fulfill some sort of contractual obligation to Marvel. And then like, yes, he has left acting behind, except he did a voice in something called Omniboat, a Fast Boat Fantasia in 2020. He played Lokia, the dolphin monster. What is this movie? The film is made up of several stories chronicling the life of Leyan Pipe, a 47-foot Top Gun cigarette boat from its conception through the end of human civilized. I gotta watch this fucking movie.
Wait, I know some of the people that directed on this.
Yeah, it's partially directed by Daniels. It's like,
this sounds amazing.
Lord worked on this?
Dylan Redford worked on this. Ooh, so that's my guess is how
that's how he gets to be
Robert
the dolphin.
Comes on. Wait, I have to talk to some friends because movie. I want to see
that. Sounds incredible.
The thing that, now I do think in talking about actor directors who have sort of broken through, he's one of the most successful, if not the most successful.
Absolutely.
Like Quiz Show often gets forgotten, but Quiz Show's
fucking rules. That movie
Quiz
rips.
Show is awesome. He just made, I've never seen Lions for Lambs, but I probably should.
The only Tom Cruise movie you haven't seen?
Brian and I went through our lists the other day. Because we're going to do it. Well, because we're going to do a draft with our friends.
Oh, yeah. That's gonna be
fun. We're going to do a Tom Cruise draft.
Sure.
And discovered that there are actually 5 of his movies I haven't seen.
Which can I?
I missed a lot in the beginning. I've never seen some shocking ones. Like, I haven't seen All the Right Moves. So there's like some in that
Legend?
Era. Like, I've never seen Taps. I saw Legend when I was a kid, but I never haven't seen it again. So, like, there's some in there. Yeah. But in the most recent run, Lions for Lambs is the only one I've seen. But talk about a movie with like movie stars that nobody just went away.
I haven't seen everything Redford's directed. In particular, I haven't seen his 2 most recent films, but I think. He's only directed 2 really good movies, and they're both amazing movies.
Sure.
But other than that, he seems to fall into that pitfall of he makes movies that are like a half hour too long, and you're just kind of like,
well, we do have one to cover, which is A River Runs Through It.
Quiz Show Rules is my favorite of his films. Ordinary People, very good. And then it's like, you know, River Runs
People
Through It.
People really ride for A River Runs Through It, weirdly.
I don't like that movie. I don't like it, but also
I've never seen it. It's a fly fishing movie, right?
Yeah. Horse Whisperer is a movie that should be much better than it. Just is too long. And Legend of Bagger Vance, the less said, the better. So
yes, that's fair. Can we say that Sneakers is his 10th highest grossing film in his career? Which we have.
What's his number one? Is it
Avengers Endgame? Avengers Endgame and Captain America: Winter Soldier are his number 1 and 2.
Sure.
Then it goes Indecent Proposal, Out of Africa. The Horse Whisperer.
Oh, okay.
The Sting.
Okay.
Charlotte's Web as a voice. Sure. Pete's Dragon.
Oh.
Didn't know he was in that.
He's in the 2016 one, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spy Game. Movie. Fascinating. And then Seekers. And then Butch Cassidy.
It must be like, I wonder what it looked like if you adjusted for inflation. Like that would be interesting.
That is worldwide, by the way. Let's see if US changes.
I do want to talk about another 1992 filmography very briefly, and that's Stephen Tobolowsky. A man who, if you put a gun to my head and said, what's the movie you think of most? Sneakers is the one I think of most when it comes to Stephen Tobolowsky.
Really?
100%.
Not Groundhog Day?
No. Like, just first thing off the dome, it's going to be Sneakers. I mean,
I don't know. Like, I think I watched Groundhog Day 10 billion times, so maybe that's it. But I just, I feel like, and he said that when people approach him, it's about Groundhog Day.
Well, because Ned Ryerson, right? Like, so he is in 7 movies in 1992. He is in a movie called Wedlock, which I'd never heard of. He's in Basic Instinct, a movie called Where the Day Takes You. Never heard of it. He's in Hero, that Dustin Hoffman, Stephen Frears movie, which is very strange, but kind of interesting. He's in Memoirs of an Invisible Man, Single White Female, Sneakers, and a movie called Roadside Prophets, where he plays a character named Ranger Bob.
Hey, that sounds great.
It sounds pretty good.
I think you guys need to cover it. I'm just saying.
He's really good in this movie, Emily. What are your thoughts on Tobolowsky and Sneakers?
I think Tobolowsky's always very good. Like he's definitely doing the Stephen Tobolowsky thing. but he's very fun. Like the movie, again, the movie kind of deflates
by the time it gets to him. You're bored.
But like, it's good that he's there because he like perks up that section of the movie. But it definitely feels like it really builds to the midpoint, and then like, you know,
well, it's
Redford moves really slow.
Redford does move very slowly. I think that you're highlighting something that I agree with, Emily, which is that the Liz dating, not Liz Hannah, Liz the character dating,
me dating.
I mean, if you dated Werner Barnes, you mean that'd be pretty cool.
I would date Werner.
Brandes, that is Werner Brandes. I mean, come on. It's obviously Strath Aaron's your boy in this. Don't be crazy.
I know. No. I'm Redford and I. We're going off.
I don't think there's any. It's very hard for me because River Phoenix was like my first crush in life. Sure. But like, peak hotness. Redford is peak hotness in this movie. Just going through this conversation and like looking through his, there's a lot that you could talk about with like Butch Cassidy or The Sting young Redford, but like, man, he's that baseball jacket and those jeans.
Where's those jeans?
I'm just old enough now that if I dated 1992 Robert Redford, I wouldn't start an age gap discourse on Twitter, but I could still be his like younger, hotter girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what I was getting at on the Liz and Werner Brandes dating is that is where I think you probably could have tightened the film a little bit. I think that it does kind of, I know it's supposed to be quote unquote suspenseful and it's part of our mission, but it does feel like if you compress that a little bit, I think it would have gone a long way towards to your point. I think there's like 10 minutes out of this movie that could have helped.
Yeah, I think you get 50, you get 10 to 15 out of this, and it's a much bigger hit. I don't know.
I agree. I think it's the part where like on the VHS tape, you kind of like stop paying attention and then, it's okay. I'm just going to change for a second to Sidney Poitier.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is just an icon. Like, I saw him speak at when AFI was still doing those like 10 movies, one night thing at the Arclight, RIP the Arclight. I saw him introduce In the Heat of the Night one night, and it was like he had like a 6-page letter that he read. It was amazing. It was like, and he talked about sort of his career and his place in Hollywood and like what this movie meant and sort of what has happened since. It was amazing. And there, him in this movie is so fucking weird. Like the casting of him in this movie, it's like when anybody puts Terrence Malick on a director's list, where you're like, yeah, sure. Okay. Like, I want to know the development executive who was like, let's go to Sidney Poitier for this. Because it's just like, there's no reason why he should take it. Having said that, like, he's incredible in the role and he's perfect for the movie because he's Sidney Poitier, so, and he'd be perfect in anything. He's so funny. Ugh. I want to talk about his career for a little bit because I have a reveal for you guys that's coming up.
Oh.
First of all, so he has, 20, 25 years of sort of being like one of the most iconic actors of all time. Sure. Then he becomes the director of sort of vastly different films that never really do that great, but he does a ton of movies. He directs like 8 movies up from 1972 until 1990 when he directs Ghost Dad.
Okay.
Which is where he meets Phil Alden Robinson. And then this is why he's in Seekers.
Yeah, it all tracks. I'm putting up my conspiracy wall.
I love it so much.
He directs a musical in 1985 called Fast Forward. Like, he directs a comedy crime called Hanky Panky in 1982. He does Stir Crazy in 1980. Like, he does some really weird stuff that I don't think people would say, like
Denzel
Washington did Fences.
He did.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, Denzel Washington is, like, making serious shit. Yeah. Kevin Costner is making serious shit. Redford is making serious shit. Sidney Poitier is like, you know what I'm going to do? Hanky Panky. Like, I love it.
I want the Criterion. You know how people make fake Criterion covers? Somebody make one for Ghost Dad, a film by Sidney Poitier.
I want to say, though,
yeah,
his comedic delivery in this movie,
it's incredible.
It's very specific and it's incredible. There is a moment near the end of the film before Redford has to walk very slowly where Sidney Poitier says, "You get all the fun stuff," but says it in a way that he's just like, "I don't want anything to fucking do with the shit that you have to do." And
yeah,
it's just, he's just wonderful. And on top of the fact that he also has this relationship with his wife, she has, I think, mm-hmm, 2 scenes, maybe a scene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if she's in the end, scene, but she's in the party scene. Yeah.
Right. And you're just like, they seem like a totally reasonable married couple. They seem lovely. They seem to, yep, like,
they have dinner parties. They hang out.
He's running the gamut in this movie.
He's always wearing a suit, which is amazing.
Yes.
His relationship with Aykroyd, whose fantastic name is Mother, is so great, where Mother is just constantly asking about CIA conspiracies. It's so funny. Like, the first scene when he's like, "So did the earthquake happen before or after you retired?" It's like, it's so good. And he's just like, "I can't deal with this guy." It's also interesting that he's kind of playing like the older guy in the team, even though I'm pretty sure him and Redford are the same age. Yeah. But like, he's playing a little bit more the, like,
totally.
Well, do we also ever find out why he left the CIA? I can't remember.
Yes, he had a temper. Remember?
Oh, right.
But I also feel like all of Aykroyd's conspiracy theories are things he actually believes. But
here's the thing about Dan Aykroyd.
Yes,
like, please. I don't think I he's a conspiracy theorist. And like, every movie he's in now, or for most of his career, has written that in, like, all the crazy shit he believes, and the characters make fun of him for it. And he's so game to do that. Mm-hmm. And like, this movie has some conspiracies in it that if he literally believed them, I would be like, "You do not possess a brain, sir." But like, I don't think like, but he's so willing to be like, "Okay, you can make fun of my beliefs. Like, you can go that far." Mm-hmm. And I'm fat.
It's like, interesting.
We've talked about him a lot on this show because he's in a lot of, like, this is kind of peak Aykroyd, which is I know the reason you wanted to do 92, Phil.
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's coming off his Oscar nomination.
Your fellow Canadian.
Driving Miss Daisy.
But yeah, it's his willingness
to just be like,
"Please make fun of me for believing JFK is still alive somewhere." And you're like, "Okay, sure."
The whole thing is pretty crazy. This movie has a deep bench of interesting character actors too. It's Donald Logue's first role as Gunter. Mm-hmm. Not something I ever would have imagined he would get cast in, but he's good in it. I think that Redford and McDonald have great chemistry. I really think that they feel, I really liked them together. I also like that it's a passion fish reunion with her and Streth Aaron.
Do we remember the 90s sitcom Soul Man?
Nope.
I just was looking it up because that was like one of the reasons I liked Aykroyd back in the day. It was like, I want to see when this show began. I think it's 97. By 97, he has fallen so far that he's doing a network TV sitcom for ABC called Soul Man, which is a spinoff of Home Improvement, about a minister. And that's why I watched it, because it was a good show about Christianity. And like,
oh boy.
But I just was looking it up, and this is literally the only thing that I care to say about it. Its first season was a 3-episode order. They got a 3-episode order, and they were all big hits because it was after Home Improvement. And then they ordered 22 episodes and nobody watched it. Actually, no, it was the 29th biggest show.
I question. I don't remember a minister on Home Improvement. So how is it a spinoff?
Because he appears, it's the famous backdoor pilot. He appears in one episode and then they're okay. And then they had cross pollination. He was Al Borland's minister. And
I'm sorry, we're talking about Dan Aykroyd.
Dan Aykroyd played the minister. And then it also Zachary Ty Bryan was like in one episode, they were like, and Zachary Ty Bryan goes to this church. Do the rest of the Taylors? No, because we can't afford them. But this one kid does.
Dan Aykroyd
also was like notoriously difficult, right? Like this is okay. So yes. Interesting. I would have loved to have been on set of this, of Sneakers, where Redford and Poitier were like, no, sir, we do not. We do not behave like
we do not have anything to
No, sir. Imagine Poitier being pissed off at you? It's like the scariest thing I could ever think about. Of just like,
his intensity is incredible.
Just disappointment. Like, yeah. It's like when your parents would say, like, I'm not mad, I'm disappointed. I just feel like would really hurt me. And I would never recover.
So I want to have a
conversation with Dan Aykroyd where we discuss our very different interpretations of the phrase ghost protocol. Like, I just want to, I just think that'd be fun.
I want to talk for just a quick second about how horny this movie is in odd ways.
I feel like we've been talking about that the whole time, Phil, but I'm excited.
I think that's more about like how we feel about the movie. But I think in terms of inside the film itself, we do have this whole like Gunter's having an affair with this lady and they're surveilling, like they're watching this through the whatever.
Another thing that feels like teenage boys.
Yes.
Just like,
All of the shit that they say during
that. What I'm saying. It's so teenage.
But also the Redford almost saying what David Strathairn tells. It's David Strathairn who tells him to say it, right?
It is David Strathairn who over. So,
but like Poitier is standing right next to him, and they're like joking about it.
They're like tee-hee-tee-hee.
Yeah,
like little kids on the other side. I mean, there's also just the Playboy, the Braille Playboy, is how we are introduced to Whistler
in his little soundproof section of the van.
This joke that Liz is referring to is basically there's this moment when Redford is caught by the mistress. I don't even think it's a mistress. I just think it's a woman he's having sex with, but it doesn't matter. In Janik's office, and they're in his ear feeding him stuff to say to her, because apparently Redford is so stupid he can't like just do this on the fly. He needs two idiots in a van to tell him what to say. And basically at the end of it, they tell him to tell her to give him head every time he wants it. And you're just like, first of all, this joke is gross and lame and shouldn't exist at any point.
But he
almost says it. It's like, do you have a brain, good sir? What are you doing?
It's so funny though. Like, just I don't know. This is also Sidney Poitier's second to last movie. His next movie that he retires on is The Jackal.
It's a choice.
But so that will, you know. So I think let's talk about this one, which is this. I kind of get it. Like, I kind of get that he's like, I want to go out and have fun. Like, I want to have fun on a movie. Like, I'm Sidney Poitier. I want to like hang out with my bros and do this. Yeah. And like, no one ever let me tell blowjob jokes for the last 50 years. Like, that just feels great. I love it for him. I'm thrilled for us. I'm thrilled.
I agree.
I do wonder if there is a thing where for so long, Sidney Poitier was the serious black actor and like the one with gravitas. And then Denzel comes along and now he's like, okay, I can tell blowjob jokes.
Yeah, I do think this was kind of like the Fences thing for me is like when you're talking about, not that I definitely should be the person to be diagnosing this conversation as an extremely white woman.
Yes, but to be clear, we're all very white.
We're all very white.
Yeah. So, but I think we also have to bring up the fact that Sidney Poitier, until Denzel shows up, is the most important, most prolific black actor in Hollywood and in the world, and even still in the beginning of Denzel's run is until like they kind of do a handoff, and then now Denzel is kind of in his older Sidney Poitier age. I think the thing that sort of just like as we've been talking about, I've been thinking about like hanky panky versus fences. Sure. I think it's kind of interesting and problematic potentially that it's like, if you're Denzel, do you only get to do fences? Do you only, are you only allowed as a filmmaker? I don't know that that's true, but we, what I do know is true that is that obviously there have been much stricter and much more harmful restrictions put on Black actors in what they've been, frankly, quote unquote, allowed to do in their careers. So I think it, that's just a conversation that I think is worth having, particularly when you look at Sidney Poitier's directing career, where he was like, fuck it, I'm going to go have fun. And like, I don't care if it makes you think I'm not a serious filmmaker.
I do think I think one thing, like, so Sidney Poitier, the thing is like the other Black actors who become at that level of fame are comedy stars.
Yeah.
And so like he kind of gets, you know, with Denzel, at least he found the action lane. So he can sort of go between, I'm going to do an action movie and I'm going to do a big serious movie. And also like, as he's like sort of transitioning to elder statesman, you've got Daniel Kaluuya and Michael B. Jordan. And like, there's a host of guys coming up behind him in a way that Poitier didn't have because of the structural racism of Hollywood. So like, it, which still exists to be clear, but was like a different mutated form in the 70s and 80s. So like, I think it is, I'm so glad he got to play a horny old man.
Me
like,
too.
I think he should have gotten more chances.
That's what I'm saying. I like, could you imagine seeing him in something? Because it feels like this is kind of what he wanted to do. It was like, did you see the movies I directed? Like, I want to talk about blowjobs.
Do you think that Denzel will have his moment when he's, because like, I'm looking at Denzel's filmography here, and I mean, I got to be honest, The Preacher's Wife is the closest thing to like a lighthearted rom-com-y kind of thing.
I wonder if the reception to that scared him off, because people didn't really like that movie. Yeah,
people did not like that movie. But I also feel like Denzel has been funny in many movies, right? Like the guy clearly knows how to deliver a joke. So like, I do hope that maybe at some point he gets to flex that muscle a little bit. Maybe he doesn't want to.
I mean, I think he's funny in every movie. Like, I think he has the thing. Yes. Like, I think it's similar to Sidney Poitier, where Sidney Poitier can be in the most dramatic film of all time and sort of like give a look. And he, like, he, you know, all great actors that are dramatic are funny. Like, I just think it is like that's part of it. You understand timing, you understand comedy.
Sure.
But I think it's interesting that that Denzel has sort of not gone into that fully lane. Like I just listened to the Ringer Denzel draft, and which is how the draft of another actor came up. So I was like, well, we can't tell Denzel, we just talked about him. But listening to his career and sort of looking at his oeuvre, a lot of the action movies are like almost action comedies. Like his role in a lot of them is sort of the comedic role, you know, it's kind of interesting that that's how he flexed his muscle was like, all right, I'm going to do this. And mostly with Tony Scott, like I'll do this, but I'm going to be funny in it. So I think it's sort of interesting to see generationally how this hopefully continues to change.
He's weirdly like, and this is not weird because Macbeth's a darkly funny play, but he's very funny in Macbeth. Like he's a very funny Macbeth.
He is.
That's Coen Brothers too, which I think is interesting. Yeah. You know.
Absolutely.
Also, by the way, if we cast this movie now, Denzel is 100% playing that role, and he's still like hot gramps. I'm in. Like,
who
is
Redford
hot
today?
Who's the captain? I think it's Cate Blanchett.
Would watch the fuck out of that.
Yeah.
I think we get Cate Blanchett in that role.
Oh my god. So I want to talk about
Pitt.
What I would
honestly now, like, do you go Brad Pitt?
Yeah, I mean there is
Cate Blanchett is a PH freak. Let's just
she definitely is a PH freak.
I want to talk about what
also,
I would
so she
I,
and Creasy fuck in this movie with a PH.
Great.
Yeah.
I think the most iconic scene in this movie is the Scrabble scene. I think it's so, you know, they're at a party, Whistler's kind of fucking around with the black box that they've got, and they're trying to figure out what C-Tech astronomy really means. So they're kind of rearranging the letters to figure out what it means. It ultimately means too many secrets, which is whatever, but like
no notes,
no notes. The way it's shot, I love under the glass table with the various Scrabble tiles. I think that it's got this great kind of, that to me is sort of the movie in one scene, which is this sort of ominous, what is the box? What can it do? The playfulness of what they're trying to do with the Scrabble letters. I think all that stuff just works incredibly well. I thought it was so much deeper into the movie, though. I couldn't believe that it was like a half hour into the movie.
Yeah.
It's such it's a crazy. Weird... It's so, like the stuff where she dates Tobolowsky feels like it should come in the first half, and it's like
totally
like in the third act.
Yeah, it's crazy. I also think, Liz, that you will have thoughts on this, as will you, Emily, but there was stuff like all of the kind of the conspiratorial elements. The moment that made me think this the most was when Redford's handing off the box, and you've got Poitier at the car, and on a newspaper article, he sees that Yannick has been killed. It felt so Grisham movie to me. Like, it felt so like when someone could be found out with this tension of a newspaper article. So all that kind of stuff, like even the scene when like the diplomat is shot, like all that stuff felt kind of 90s Grisham kind of.
I mean, Poitier and Redford not being in a Grisham movie just feels weird. Like it's sort of like that just feels like a weird thing that didn't happen. So this is kind of their like goofy version of that. Yes. I just like personally, I hate. Watch, I'm gonna say this, and then like my next movie has to have it because I'm not smart enough to make it more creative. But like, I kind of hate when you just like see something in an article like serendipitously. Yes. Right. Also, when it's like, I don't know. I just think like, what? Oh my god, they're about to meet. He just so happens to read in the newspaper that moment that this is about to happen. Yeah. So like, if I'm gonna give a note, that's the note I'm gonna give, which is like, very there's a little too much serendipitousness in this. Sure. But having said that, like. For a movie that doesn't have any set pieces, except as we mentioned, Whistler driving blind van driver.
Yeah.
Like the way that they create tension in this movie is pretty impressive. Like there's not, and by the way, I think James Horner's score is doing heavy work on that. Like his score, it's a weird ass score from him. I think like it's. Yeah. I think it's closest to Pelican Brief, which is why it's helpful in the thriller conversation. But like it, the opening with like the jazz song is just weird. You're just like, I don't know what movie I'm in. And the way that it's utilized is big and all over the place. Like there's score all over this movie. It is not a quiet film. So I think it's like, they knew that it was not a thriller and they were trying to sell it as a thriller. And so they were, it feels like they coded the movie in score to help them.
They're goosing it a lot with the score for sure. But to your point about
like a cocktail party.
The cocktail, sure. The way that they find tension, one of my favorite scenes is the trace phone call scene, right? Mm-hmm. Where like you've got them tracing it and the government's trying to figure out where they are, and Whistler has like 9 different countries that it needs to be traced through. And it's just like, do you want our protection? And like all that kind of stuff is, you know, that's the juice of the movie.
And they can lie detect over the phone because that was a thing hackers could do before they got lazy.
Freaks, if you
freaks.
Will.
Freaks.
Those freaks.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting sort of like putting it on in the same conversation as Oceans or the first Mission Impossible movie.
Yes.
Where that, because the first Mission Impossible movie is what, 94, 95?
96.
Like it's not
96.
Oh, really? Okay. But still, 96. So 4 years later, obviously not a comedy.
No.
But has a lot of shared elements of this. Like I just rewatched it. It's like way more of a thriller and a heist movie than it is a spy action movie that the franchise has become. There's again, there's very few set pieces except for the train and the fall, which is still just him really doing that.
Silent as well. Like just
completely silent.
It's the best.
Absolute silence, sir. Absolute silence. But I think it's interesting putting them sort of as a piece because they're all doing the same thing to, in my opinion, great success in very different ways. Where like Oceans is big set pieces. Like there's set pieces all over that movie. Plus it's like just we're swinging for comedy and we're swinging for like, we know that 3 out of 6 of these men are sexiest men of the year. Like they're all on the cover of People magazine. There's like, we have a lot of movie stars, 4. How dare I? 4. talk to me about Garcia one day. Just peak hotness in that movie. Peak.
Sure.
I think, like, talking about this, like, we know we have two real movie stars. Like, we have the two guys who are holding this up.
Sure.
It's not really a comedy. It's not really a drama. It's sort of a thriller. So it's like kind of a mashup of both. I don't know. It's sort of like, again, I don't know why this movie works. It's the more you talk about it, the more you're like, this shouldn't work at all.
Well, and also the more you talk about it, it makes me feel like what Emily was saying, which is like, how do you market this movie? Like, I don't know what the trailer was. And I'm kind of curious now to go on YouTube and see if it's up there. Cause there's a part of me that's like, it is a comedy. It is a thriller. It does have sort of kind of some action-y kind of set pieces. Like when you're talking about Mission Impossible, I was, you know, when he's walking slowly and they're turning the temperature up, like that made me think so much of the, you know, the vault scene in Mission Impossible. So yeah, it is kind of this weird match.
Too less success, I would say.
Much, much less success. Yes. I also think like this is also the beginning. I don't know when it actually started, but like computer dating.
Mm-hmm.
And like that whole thing, the fact that Martin at once says he's a computer dater, which is like, I don't think anyone was ever actually called that. But like, there is just sort of this, it's so early in the technology of so much of this, which is kind of what you sense too. There's this lo-fi-ness to it that I think is also kind of fascinating. But yes, Emily?
93 is the year the internet really breaks through in the public consciousness.
Right.
It's so fucking weird how this movie this movie's like 6 months before the internet becomes a thing. Everybody like, oh, a thing everybody knows. Either they have it in their homes or it's coming. And I don't know.
But it's what's funny about that is like you read it in Ebert's review, like that review is so perfect in the sense that he's just like, what this fucking technology blah, blah, like you're it's like he's just
if only
so,
he
like,
knew if only he knew
it's just kind of amazing that we're in that position. But
so I just rewatched In the Line of Fire and
good movie.
Excellent. And then I'm in the middle of a Clear and Present Danger rewatch. Both very fascinating movies to talk about this.
Sure.
Like to talk about technology and like the place that it has, I think in sort of this era of 90s classic films, of like classic blockbuster films, where like in Clear and Present Danger, there's a moment where they have to connect conversation over their computers, but they can't do it because there's no internet. So it's just like local internet. So, but like somebody can see if you've signed on. So he's like rushing to print something so that Ritter doesn't see that he signed on. And you're like, man, this was edge of your seat thriller in like 1997. Like like when this was on television all the time, I was like, woo. Still, well, when like, you watch it, you're like, this is great.
When we did our Patriot Games episode, Emily, you might remember the break into the phone call conversation that we had where like you could like break into a phone call. Was that?
Right. When he's calling on the car and he's like, it's an emergency.
It's like, call, you need to break it. It's like, break into a phone. It's like, but yeah, it's crazy.
That's I think to me, the turning point is Independence Day. Because Independence Day, they do
in
the
a positive
thing,
or negative way,
in just in a way of like people thinking about movies in terms of tech, because they log in to the alien computer and infect it with a virus. And people love that movie. I love that movie. I think it's very fun. But that makes no fucking sense. And everyone called it out at the time. And it was like, you know, like that. That was when you suddenly realized that tech had infiltrated American society enough you couldn't get away with like fudging the details.
Well, I think what's I agree. And to further that, like what's interesting is that the majority of that movie is Jeff Goldblum being like a super hacker scientist where we don't understand what he's doing the entire time. Like he's just found a countdown and he doesn't know what that means. And then he gets drunk and gives the thing a virus. But like, that's really interesting that they knew enough that they were like, technology has to be present in this movie and like modern technology. And we have to be aware of obviously aliens are smarter than us. So we have to deal with the fact that they're smarter than us, but they didn't know enough of how to break that into story and like to make it also Mary McDonald.
I want to
phenomenal in that movie, by the way.
I just remember I was at some sort of camp and we went and saw that movie and some fucking smart little piece of shit kid was like, boy, good thing the aliens don't use MS-DOS. And I was like, what are you talking about? I fucking hate that kid. And I just got my revenge on him. I got my revenge.
Congrats.
I remember just weeping when Mary McDonnell dies. It was a tough one. That was a tough one.
That's a hard one. I mean, she's really good. I want to just have you. I have a very brief In the Line of Fire story to tell because you just watched it.
Yeah.
So they're shooting a scene. Wolfgang Peterson's directing the film, and it's Rene Russo and Clint Eastwood. I think they're walking around the Washington Monument, or they're walking around Washington somewhere. And it's like a wide shot, and they like walk into a poster or whatever. And so they shoot the scene. They do a take, and Wolfgang calls cut. And he goes up to Clint and he gives him some notes. He's like, so we're going to do it again. I'd like you to do this, whatever. And Clint turns to him and says, could you hear me? He's like, yes. Was I in focus? Yes. We're moving on.
Okay. So to add to that, I have subtitles on my at all times because I'm old and I can't hear anything. And so there's just always on. I challenge everyone to put on the Netflix version of In the Line of Fire. I realized we owned it, so I haven't checked the one we own, but put that on and have the sound on as well. Clint says absolutely nothing as it is subtitled, which tells me that the person just put the script in.
Yep.
And he did said whatever he wanted. There is a slight misting of accuracy in terms of like sometimes you have to use the word the, and like we're all getting to the same point, but he like what was amazing is there's one of the scenes between him and Malkovich is like they're doing one of the phone calls. Malkovich says every single thing as it is noted in the captions, and you go to Clint and he's just having a parade over there. He's like, I'm gonna go over here, I'm not gonna say that, I'm right. not gonna say it right. is wild. So bless you, Clint. Like love you.
Love you. There's also a moment I went to see. I think I was one of the few people that saw Jersey Boys, the movie that he directed, in theaters. And there's a moment where
Emily did you just tip your hat?
Emily just did a little hat tip. There's a moment where there's a family scene or whatever, and there's a teenage girl looking straight down the barrel of the camera for the entire scene, and you're just like, get another take, Clint. Like, come on, man.
But well, I love this in comparison to like Fincher, who Fincher's like, gotcha. That person isn't walking like a human, so we have to do 27 more takes. Sorry, Emily.
Well, one of the great things about Clint is he, you know, makes so many movies, he'll sometimes have double features, and that was the year he released Jersey Boys and American Sniper in the same year. And American Sniper, of course, has the famous, we couldn't get the baby we wanted, so we're just using this sack of cloth we found. We're going to pretend it's a baby.
Of potatoes, some rice. That's a baby. That's fine. It's one of the most shocking things I've seen in a long time.
It's the magic incredible. Of the movies, honestly.
It is. It's movie magic.
By the way, a double feature. Let's just talk about that for a second.
I mean, I do think that this movie, in terms of like how it ends.
Jersey Boys?
Yes, obviously.
This movie, I mean, it needs to be said that, Liz, you're absolutely right that like Whistler driving blind is really the climax of this movie, because then you've got like a bunch of talking, you have like the swap of the black box, and he, you know, Martin gets away with it, whatever, and you have sort of this, you know, detente between him and Cosmo, but like they just kind of get away with it, and then they just kind of run off. I even think the James Earl Jones scene, which we referred to earlier, where he's an NSA agent who basically is like, you know, what do you guys want, is it's fun and it's cute, but it's also just like, it's very neat. This movie ends with like the bow of bows.
This is
it's
also crazy. Like the thing about this movie is that it is one of the other interesting political things about it is it's in this period of time when like the American security state is kind of like fun and cuddly in movies.
Yes.
Like the NSA in this movie is like, everyone's like, well, what does the NSA do? And they're like, well, we certainly don't spy on your phone calls. And I'm like, hey, fuck you.
I know. I love it when he's like, we make sure that the government's technology is phone calls are secure, right, or whatever. Right. I was like, what?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to talk about James Earl Jones because I feel we haven't spent enough time discussing his appearance in this film.
Let's talk about him. I mean, he's great in Field of Dreams as well. I mean,
he's for me is sort of the most surprising person in this movie. Like he comes in for one scene, which is totally because of Phil Alden Robinson. So I get it. He is playing the complete opposite. Outside of Field of Dreams, where he's the lead comedic actor of the film, like, James Earl Jones, for the majority of his career, outside of what is a stage actor. He's like one of the most important stage actors of all time. I mentioned Fences before, like his performance in Fences is iconic and world renowned. He is like a very serious stage actor who then comes and plays Darth Vader and sort of like his whole world changes. Sure. And then he kind of plays, like, by the way, this role a lot. Like, he's in all of the Jack Ryan movies. Yes. He's, you know, he always kind of plays like the older statesman. Sort of. Yeah. Like the father figure, grandfather figure type of guy. He comes into this movie and he's like, mostly just fuck you. Like, he just is basically in this movie like, fuck you, bunch of kids. You totally ruined this for me. And I don't like it. And it's like mean dad showed up instead of nice dad. And it's so much fun to watch cranky, mad James Earl Jones have to talk about getting a Winnebago. And then, like, River Phoenix is like, I don't want anything. I just want her number. Yeah. And he's like, this isn't a dating service.
Yeah.
This is the United States government.
And then Redford's like, just you can chaperone them going to drinks.
I do think I love that scene because it does add that establishment pole that I think the movie's kind of missing. And like, I think Poitier, because he's ex-CIA, is supposed to represent that, but he's also just like one of the boys in a fun way. So like, I do think James Earl Jones, like, if he was in two more scenes as this cranky guy that Redford has to work, I think that sort of makes the political balance feel a little bit more meaningful.
I agree.
In a weird way.
Mary McDonnell, I'm fine.
I'm fine. She's wonderful. I mean, I wanted to talk about the River Phoenix component of this scene, right? Which in lesser hands would be just downright creepy and terrible. And it definitely, you know, hedges that a little bit. But there is something very cute about her being like, you can have anything in the world and you just want my number. It's really, and they do have, like, they're just both really cute. Like, it works just based on like the casting or whatever, like on the page.
And it's also that he said it, he's like talked about it throughout the movie that he like wants to find somebody like Liz, which is really and Redford's like, no like, but there's multiple times. I think it would be creepy if it happened at the beginning of the movie rather than the end, where like, now we've spent 2 hours with him and so we get it. He also is River Phoenix, so we're okay with
and
it.
And he also says, the lady with the Uzi. It's hot. Yeah, it that scene ultimately shouldn't work, as most of this movie shouldn't work. And it is this kind of deft touch that this movie is playing with. And then, you know, as we mentioned, like, it's they should all be dead. The sequel of this movie would be that they're all hunted for their lives.
By the way, the sequel for this movie is they're on the run because they've now disrupted the entire geopolitical communications system.
The sequel for this movie is they're all dead and God hires them to break into hell. To break into hell's computer system.
Sure.
And then be like, I'll have you be back alive. So then film three is the government's like, why are these guys back? This is great.
Right. I thought we killed them.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, I love also how fast this scene is.
Yes.
Like, the dialogue in this movie is really great. I think the screenplay is really good. Outside of like a couple dated things and I mean, just structurally, and then some rough, there's some rough jokes towards the end of the movie.
What was the joke that you referred to earlier?
Okay, so I really don't understand this. It's when Redford goes in. So I fully apologize if this is an offensive joke because I just didn't understand. I don't understand it.
Now I'm excited.
It's the scene when Redford goes in. Emily's already making me really uncomfortable like getting telling real close story.
To the story. I'm seeing how my hat looks when I get up.
It's when Redford goes in with West Wing and Papa Kent. And he's like, I could have joined the NSA, but they found out my parents were married. Papa Kent gets really mad at him and tries to go after him. And then
he's making a joke about them. He's saying they wanted me, but they found out my parents weren't married, I think is the joke. I think he's saying like they're inbred. That's the impression that I got.
Okay.
I agree with you.
Emily, do you have any thoughts?
I just have decided it's queerphobic. I don't know, honestly
there was a part of me
that thought he was making a joke about those two guys being a couple. I couldn't quite parse.
Okay.
Yeah.
It frankly had like queerphobic vibes to it, mm-hmm. which is, it just like, I don't know, it just like felt like very bro-y weird. Of how angry the guy gets, and like very macho-y, yeah.
yes.
of like, that feels like that vibe, mm-hmm. but it was such a weird joke. And I've watched this movie so many times, and I'm like, I have had to think about, like, this one is just like not one off the top of your head that you get. The inbred yeah. thing actually makes more sense to me. In total,
that was my take.
The inbred thing totally makes sense to me now that you say it. That's what makes sense. Yeah,
okay.
I get that.
I pulled up yeah. the script. I'm going to figure this out. Please continue okay. talking.
Let's rate this movie, because I would love to hear Liz's thoughts on the film that we're covering next week as well. A movie that I imagine she quite likes, but who knows? In 92, I loved this movie. I probably would have given this film like a 93 as a 12-year-old mm-hmm. through my teens. I watched this a ton. It's gone down a little bit, just being a little bit more critical of it. I'm at like at 86 now. Like, I still really love this movie. I think that most of my notes ultimately were just sort of like the pacing's a little bit wonkier than I remembered it yeah. being. But I also kind of weirdly respect it, if that makes any sense. Like, I respect the fact that you couldn't write a script like this today, structurally speaking. Like, I think it just would have to be a lot more set piecing and whatever. So that's where I'm at. What about you, Emily? Where are you?
80.
All right.
I'm giving it a 3. I'm giving it a 3 on the queerphobia scale. Like, 3 is kind of my baseline, because okay. I'm like, I just assume, unless the movie does something to prove me wrong, I just assume everybody in it is queerphobic for any movie from 1992.
That's interesting.
In 1992, I think that's
and like,
fair.
There's just like that. There were a couple jokes that had, again, this vibe of like, are you making right. fun of these guys for being gay? It just like, the script is like more clever, too clever by half. And that's what saves it from, you know.
There's also some extreme stark racism in the end of the movie, yeah. which we did not yes. discuss. But, mm-hmm. and I it's not. Helps
kind of
by the
out of
fact
nowhere a little
it
bit
comes
too, right?
completely out of nowhere, right. and I think the only reason it's not like a huge red flag is Sidney Poitier that beats the shit out of them, which is great. which you gotta love yes. watching Sidney Poitier beat the shit out of racists.
Absolutely.
But like, the racism just totally comes out of nowhere.
So, yes, okay, sorry.
I think that, but there's some wonky stuff in this movie that it's 1992 and there's all white guys except for Poitier, so you're sort of like questioning.
No, totally. And Emily, to sort of highlight what you were saying, because they feel so childish, because they all feel kind of like kids, there is a little bit of that energy of like, you know, ladies and boobs and like blowjobs, and like, it all feels kind of very kind of infantile
it
in that way.
So. Like, it feels like we're 5 seconds away from Redford saying you're gay and Poitier saying your mom's gay.
Yes, I agree.
I can't dispute that. Yeah. Liz, what were you and where were you? I mean, yeah.
I was probably pretty high. I was probably in the like early 90s of that. I think I'm going to go probably like 87. 86, 87, probably right around where you are, Phil.
Yeah.
I think it's lost something for me, but everything that it loses, it feels like it gains a little bit.
Different
like
ways,
as
yeah.
like it's one of those movies that as you get older, you just unfortunately relate more to the characters. And I don't know, there's something like really fun about watching grown-up Goonies. It's like, that's just really fun. And it's also, on my scale, it's a packing movie. It's a classic packing movie,
which is
very important for me. Like, the movies you throw on while you're packing and you can kind of tune out for 20 minutes and come back in. Mm-hmm. You never turn it off because you're like, I got to watch this. And you definitely sit down for a while and stop packing to watch a good scene. Mm-hmm. But hard to find those movies. And this is definitely a packing movie.
My packing movie is Midsommar. I'm just realizing like the way, like the comfort movies, like all of mine are horror movies. It's just like... I will throw on The Thing. I'll throw on The Exorcist. I'll just be like having a ball.
That's
just
incredible.
Doing chores. So
this is my husband as well.
That is
watches
incredible.
Horror movies just for fun.
So next week we have your better half coming on. Emily.
Mine? Oh,
no.
Okay.
Sorry, Liz. Emily, your better half, Libby, is coming on to talk about A League of Their Own with us.
Yes.
Wow.
What are your thoughts on A League of Their Own, Liz?
I mean, extremely high. Are you guys going to talk about the show as well?
No. Maybe
it didn't
we'll
come
watch
out in 92.
Maybe we'll watch it.
But I'm just
thinking
in conversation with
her.
I think, a lot of the problems of the 92 movie, the show tried to answer, which is why I bring them up in conversation, because I think there's a lot of things that were obviously omitted from the 92 film that you can't ignore at this point. The fact that like there wasn't just a black woman standing in the back throwing like the greatest throw of all time.
Sure.
So very acknowledging that.
It's very queer too. Like,
yes. Extremely queer in a way that I think obviously was accurate to this time and this story in particular, and was ignored in 92. So I think that like is important. Having said all that, it's a phenomenal for me movie. Like changed my world, was very important to me. I also was a softball player growing up, so like very important to me. I was a catcher because of Daddy. Like hugely influential film for me. I personally, it's my favorite Hanks performance.
I was just gonna say,
I think he's so good in this movie and he's so funny. Gina Davis is great. The fact that Gina Davis was cast like 2 days before they started shooting is amazing. Lori Petty is incredible. I mean, Rosie, Madonna.
It's one of
your
those
boy
movies.
David Strathairn. Like, come on now, let's go.
Yeah, you got him back, Emily. Your husband, you know, he's in it.
So I love it. I'm thrilled to listen to the pod and hear how you guys feel. But I hope it's positive.
I'd be surprised if it wasn't. It's going to be in my top 10 movies. Yeah.
It might be my favorite movie of 92 still, if I'm being completely honest. I mean, just pure like, the rewatchability of it for me. I've seen
packing
it innumerable
movie.
Times.
Classic packing movie.
It's just a really lovely movie too. Like it's just, it's funny. I also, you know, you mentioned Hanks and we'll talk about this on the episode, Emily, but like, it does feel like it's a fulcrum point for him. Like it's definitely a turning point in his career, because everything that sort of, you know, Philadelphia is right after it. It does. And so Sleeps in Seattle, like it does feel like he kind of figures out the other gear that he wasn't figuring out.
Also, well, his career also had been back.
That's what I was gonna say, is his career was also kind of tanked. Correct. And then he did this and sort of rediscovered again like who he was, and I think Penny Marshall, by the way, goes a long way into doing that, because you look at Big and then you look at this and sort of where he goes in his career.
He was trying to go in a darker space and couldn't pull it off, and League of Their Own proofs like he can do it. He just has to be like 5% more Tom Hanks, and you're like, there's the drunk I love.
Well, I think there is a lot to say about what you just said, Emily, which is like, and I think I'm going to loop back around to the sneakers conversation, because that is actually interesting, is that there is a serious portion of the reason that people love Hanks is watching the Hanksiness in a movie. Like there is, like when you watch him go fully into a character and fully out of it, it's not saying it's rejected, but it's saying like, we want Hanks, like we love Hanks. That's what we want to watch. And there's something about the movie that's like a very unique quality of a movie star, is like usually you want them to be whatever, and like with him in particular, we're like, no, we don't love your characters, we love you and everything that you are, and want to watch you do interviews and shit like that. The actors in this movie, like maybe Poitier, maybe Redford, River Phoenix, I don't know, because obviously died too young. But like, it's an interesting conversation sort of like the, I guess it's a character actor versus movie star conversation, but like really of how to define a movie star is like, do we want to see more of like kind of your personality in there? Or do we want to see you just immerse yourself in a character? Did I define movie star and character actor for myself? Okay, cool. Great.
A little bit. But I also think there are some movie stars that quite frankly are transformative, right? That like actually do become.
Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, I think there's a ton that, yeah.
Yeah. But to your point, like there are some movie stars that just need to stay in a comfort zone, and when they stray, which Hanks does all the time, by the way, and people are just like, I don't know what to make of Cloud Atlas. Like there are just people that are just like, I don't know what to do with this stuff. I know Cloud Atlas is a
no, I just was going to say, I would argue that that both Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, for which he both wins Oscars, are him doing that, but staying just enough. Yeah, it's interesting.
No, totally. I'm curious. Have you guys seen the infamous deleted scene from A League of Their Own? Do you know what I'm even speaking of?
Are you talking about the kiss?
Yes.
I have not seen it, but I've heard.
I've heard about it. It's on YouTube. I have watched it. It scarred me. And I mean, truly a movie. I love A League of Their Own so much that to see these two kiss, I was just like, how close they came to fucking ruining one of the things that makes the movie so special is just honestly makes me like kind of anxious just to think about.
I don't ever want to see it because I do think it'll almost ruin it for me. I do think it's interesting that he thought he had a shot with her because he's like a literal drunk who just got sober like 3 weeks ago. And she's
forced on him.
Yeah. And she's the greatest baseball player since Mickey Mantle. So it's an interesting thing. Yes. I don't know. I'm thrilled for you guys. I love this movie.
Plus
so
Bill
much.
Pullman. Bill Pullman's Bill a Pullman. Snack. I mean, but you're like, not gonna, I mean, come on.
Listen, Tom Hanks and League of Their Own could throw me a curveball. I'd do that. I just like revealing that I have like a bunch of repressed heterosexuality. That's what this podcast is.
I mean,
look,
peacockness
for Hanks?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
He's just so fucking funny in this movie.
He's so funny.
But he's also like so heartfelt. I think of it, there's so many scenes of him being fatherly to these women in a way that's just like, it's a real, like Penny Marshall's career is fascinating to me because like she's got a bunch of just obvious bangers, but then she's got a bunch of things where you're like, what were we doing here, Penny? Yeah. Like, why did we do this movie? The fact that she turned down Forrest Gump, which I imagine to this day I don't know what Penny Marshall's Forrest Gump looks like. Like it might have been just an absolute disaster. Like who knows? But it's just, it's really,
I mean, Hanks, there's two scenes for me that stand out in the movie. Yeah. I mean, there's so many that are good, but there's two scenes. One, when they're all rushing out of confession to church.
God knows the game.
And he goes, God, there are dozens of people waiting for us to play. I was like, it's so funny when you realize what he's saying is great. And then I know the throwing the baseball glove at Stool Angel is like the iconic moment, but like the whole scene before that, where Gina Davis shows up and he's like, oh, you're back. And they have the whole, like, you don't have to play, you're going to play. And then he like does the whole, we're going to win thing is just like peak comedy, peak Hanks. Yep. It's really, he just is so charming and such a movie star in that movie. Yep. And there's, I know that he had like a career sort of bust, and so he was he takes the low, but I'm hard pressed to be convinced that somebody of his level wouldn't take this supporting actor job. Like, you kind of talk about actors of his generation actors at that age, at that level of like, there have been movie stars, now they're fading, they're going after their Oscar, they haven't won, whatever. Like, going for the supporting actor role in something like this is really smart, and more actors should do.
I, first of all, couldn't agree with you more. Second of all, him not getting an Oscar nomination for A League of Their Own is fucking bonkers. Crazy. Bonkers. I mean, crazy to think of, and speaks to what you said, Emily, of like him being in a bit of this lull and Hollywood being like, is this guy kind of done?
I think that
but
movie
he wins
also
5 years later. Sorry.
1 year later.
He wins the next year.
No, but I mean, like, if this movie comes out 5 years later, like, he wins. Yeah. There's no,
I think that, like, it just was, like, this movie was not, it was a hit, but it wasn't, like, hugely well-reviewed. It just was kind of ignored entirely by awards season. That said, I mean, that's that supporting actor lineup. Who are you going to kick from it? David Paymer and Mr. Saturday Night? That seems
that is who I kick out of the category.
How dare you? How dare you?
Sorry.
Emily? Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's just one of those, this movie being resoundingly ignored by the Academy Awards just goes to show how, like, up their own ass they were for so long that if a movie was...
It was a girl movie. But that's crazy. The thing, it was a girl movie. I think that's the, when you look at this film in particular, like, I'm talking about sneakers, obviously. But when you, honestly, also a girl movie. Not gonna lie, we've already discussed the hotness a lot.
Sure.
But like, League of Their Own was never at that time. It wasn't a serious movie. This is kind of similar. I mean, it's not the same, but like, women were not allowed to make serious, or they were only recognized when they made serious movies. Right. You know, it's like, it took Kathryn Bigelow making The Hurt Locker for the Academy to be like, oh, women can do things. And then, you know, like, going to your shirt, like, Greta now has changed it where you could make Barbie and she's going to get a nomination, if not win. So I think, like, but the discourse is you have to be serious to be taken seriously. Yeah. And that is a shame for Penny Marshall in particular, for the career that she had. Like, Big is wild. That is a wild movie.
Wild.
Like, it's kind of, she's kind of the only person I can think of who could do it at that time.
Sure.
And like, makes Tom Hanks a movie star, and then League of Their Own is sort of, Madonna is fantastic in it.
I mean, like, the ceilings that are broken by League of Their Own, and again, we'll you know, unpack all of this, Emily, on the actual episode, but I do think it's worth noting, first female director to make $100 million movie, like the movie that will make $100 million at the box office. It was groundbreaking, and yet still Hollywood was like, but come on.
Is Awakenings the first movie to be nominated for Best Picture directed by a woman? She was not nominated for director.
Was it nominated for Best Picture?
Yes.
It was, okay.
I think it was the first movie directed by a woman. Not, and again, it and is, she went serious. Yeah, it's picture De Niro in the screenplay. Sorry.
Right. And that's the year before this? It's in 91, right?
No, that's in 1990. Yeah.
Oh, 90. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, the other thing just in terms of success of this movie is, like, I don't know how much you've already looked into this, but you should before you do the pod, is like, the production of this movie and the pre-production of this movie was harrowing. Like, this was, they were rewriting the script constantly, not to say that doesn't happen, but like, there was a little bit of a shit show in the production of this film. Sure. And this movie came out of it, which does not always happen.
I mean, it does scream. I mean, it's a phenomenal screenplay by Lugo Gans, Bob Mandel, but it does feel punch-up-y, right? Like, it's very funny, but it's, you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of like jokes in it that I imagine are coming up on the day of. But all that being said, Liz, thank you for coming on and talking about sneakers with us.
Thanks for having me. I feel like I have achieved like writer Twitter sneakers status in some way. Totally. I feel like we all have. By talking about sneakers, it feels really important.
Yeah.
This is a quick answer for next week. Awakenings was the second Randa Haynes direction of Children of a Lesser God, first Best Picture nominee directed by a woman. But she was, again, not nominated for director. So
the first director nomination.
You know what's cool about when Best Pictures are nominated, but neither the director or the writer are nominated? The actors do it all themselves.
It is cool. They're really, I mean, listen.
I think in both cases, the writers who were men were nominated and the directors who were women were overlooked. Sure. So
who is the, but who was the first woman nominated for Best Director?
Lena Wertmüller for Seven Beauties in 1972, which was not nominated for Best Picture. The first woman nominated for Best Director, who's also nominated for Best Picture, is, I think, Jane Campion. I don't think Barbara got nominated for
Prince of Tides.
Prince of Tides. So
that was like, so it's the piano.
Crazy. You have
also, I just want to say, outside of my joke, we support SAG and we love our actors. we love them. They should get everything that they want so that we can go back to making jokes about who's important on set. And we love you dearly. We'll go on the strike lines with next week.
I went on strike with SAG the other day. I did some picketing. They're so hot.
They really are. It's crazy. It just makes me feel like, I'm like, don't look at me, I'm a monster. Just leave me in my office so I can write words for you pretty people.
I have to say, it was like day 71 when they showed up on the WJ, once they, because they were supporting us, but when they went on strike, and so we joined together. First of all, it was like an influx of just energy because, you know, it was flagging. We're tired. It was really hot outside. But just suddenly, everyone got so hot on the strike lines.
And all of us were just like, oh, God. Like, I just made us feel even worse. Taking,
like, the guy, some of the guys were like, it's hot. It's a Valium. I take my shirt off and walk around with a sign. And I was like, how dare you? But thank you, sir. Like, just bless your heart. I love you. Appreciate
it. It was also one of those things where I'd be like, you're not even wearing makeup. You're not even like, you're just, you are, it's, and you are stunning. I hate all of you. It's just amazing.
Even actors who you don't think are hot are hot. It's they're like when they're not, like when you see a movie and you're like, oh, that actor's not hot. And then they show up, you're like, they're hot.
They're hot. It's just, it's hot. Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
God bless him. Saw Glenn Powell. He's a very attractive man.
I hope by the time this drops, the strike is over for SAG.
Cautious optimism, fingers crossed. But thank you for coming on, Liz. I know that it's still a little bit under the weather, so it means that much more to us.
I appreciate it. Thank you. If I made any bad jokes, just blame the medication I'm on.
But listen, you'll be back to talk about something with us at some point.
I'm sure. Well, I think we're going to we're doing some kind of... We're gonna do Patreon episode.
So it's making sense now that you guys were day drinking when we were texting about what double feature you were gonna come back on for. But it's gonna be great.
We were sitting across from each other day drinking, like on our phones talking to you. It was pretty hilarious.
I'm honored, truly. Emily in her hat will be back next week. You have to wear the hat every week now, Emily. That's the problem, is that like once you bring that kind of power to the podcast,
it's a deal point in the NBA. Is the studios like, Emily needs to wear the hat, but we'll give on all this stuff. And so I don't take this hat off anymore. I shower.
I was going to ask. So did the writers' room start before the strike?
Yeah, one day.
And you had gone. Okay. One day.
Yeah, one day. I went one day and I wasn't wearing a hat, and I'm gonna show.
I was gonna say, I was like, oh, it would be amazing if you'd never gone to the room and the room, because now you can just introduce yourself with the hat.
I'm gonna show up on Wednesday and I'm gonna be wearing the hat, and everybody's gonna applaud because they're gonna be like, we got this deal because of that hat. Everybody you knows.
Did. It's amazing. We got a deal, guys. All right. Thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you. Talk to you guys soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.